Health and Social Services Committee will come to order. It is now 3:35 on Tuesday, January 26. We're in the State Capitol Room 106, and members present in the room, our committee members present in the room, are Representative Tilton, Representative Eastman, Representative Keto, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Rep. Guerra from House Finance, Rep. Edgman, who's the Vice Chair, Rep. Johnson, and then we're joined today by Representative Sadler. Is there anybody else in the room? All right. And then, of course, myself, Representative Sponholz, Chair of the Committee. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Take this time to silence your cell phones and take them all the way off vibrate, if you please. Thank you for the duration of the meeting. I just want to remind everybody that we have Butch Garber, the House Hess Secretary from Records, and Alex Beattie Gudiche from Juno LAO for staffing the committee today. Thank you. I'm going to get that right eventually, Beattie. So, yeah. Now I'll turn the gavel over to Rep. Guerra in order for him to facilitate the Medicaid reform and expansion update and overview by the Department of Health and Social Services.
Thank you, Representative Sponholz. Welcome, everybody. Today we are going to address the sort of large comprehensive issue of Medicaid reform, Medicaid expansion, results, things still left to do. In the first meeting, we discussed the amendment process, and I just want to put the committee members on notice, and I'll take feedback from members. I think it's probably going to be easier for us to do amendments to the actual budget bills as opposed to the books, but we'll work that out before we get to the amendment process, and then again we'll forward the amendments that pass in this committee as recommendations, as committee recommendations, and I also intend to forward the amendments that don't pass to the Finance Committee just so they can see them. They won't be part of the recommendations, but members might want to see what amendments did not pass so that they can work on them. And also I'd like to note that Representative Tarr has joined the committee. With that, I'll invite up Commissioner Davidson and let her identify who else is in the room and online. And we also have, I believe, Amanda Ryder here. There she is, Amanda Ryder from the Division of Legislative Finance. Commissioner Davidson.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Brianna, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, or maybe I should say Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nukhahalak Amitlamaghanan, Valerie Davidson, Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. With me here at the table is Monique Martin, Healthcare Policy Advisor. And we have a number of folks in the room. I think in the interest of time, we introduced them the other day, a number of deputy commissioners, a number of directors who are here with us either today in the room or on the phone in case we need to bring them to the table. The last year, the department, the Department of Health and Social Services worked with the legislature during the last legislative session and to really look at comprehensive Medicaid reform in our state. The department's position and this administration's position has been that Medicaid expansion and Medicaid reform really go hand in hand. Through a lot of work, through the committee process, many, many hearings last year, we were able to work with the legislature to pass a really comprehensive Medicaid reform bill. And so we wanted to provide more detail about what was contained in that bill, as well as the progress to date. In a nutshell, I will say, if I may, I don't want to steal Monique's thunder, but I will say that it has been an incredible process working with Alaskans. We have engaged, there are 16 different work groups who are working on this. The good news is the Department of Health and Social Services is only lead on 12 of those. There are another four working groups in which another department in the administration is taking the lead on, but there have been, and we have had incredible collaboration with stakeholders throughout our state, really to really implement programs that we believe and that they believe will get us where we need to be in the future. And with that, I'm going to introduce Ms. Martin, and she will take us through the reform efforts.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Monique Martin. I'm a healthcare policy advisor at the Department of Health and Social Services. And today we're going to cover a little bit of the progress that has been made to date on implementation of the Medicaid redesign reforms included in Senate Bill 74. And then the commissioner will provide an update on Medicaid expansion, as well as sort of the federal landscape and things happening back in Washington, D.C., and how they might impact potentially our Medicaid redesign efforts here in Alaska. When we sat down to start the work of implementing SB 74, one of the things we realized right away is we needed to find some ways to communicate to the public sort of the scope of the reforms really included in SB 74. So this chart you see, we are on slide 3. We really took the reforms, kind of broke out the big components of SB 74. As the commissioner mentioned, we have 16 initiatives working every day to do the implementation of SB 74. And this is just graphic representation of those reforms, so we can really communicate to the public what's in the bill and what the department is working on. On slide 4, we had a key partner group, including 25 different organizations across the state, including organizations like the Alaska Primary Care Association, the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, the Statewide Independent Living Council, that came together back in 2015, actually, to help the department with the report Agnew-Beck published, the Medicaid Redesign and Expansion Technical Assistance Contract. And after Senate Bill 74 was signed into law, we actually reconvened those key partners to help us with the work of implementing those reforms included in SB 74. And during that initial process with Agnew-Beck back in 2015 and our key partners, we discussed a little bit of a vision of Medicaid redesign at first. And it was a topic that came back up. Our key partners really wanted to sort of put pen to paper and talk about what is our vision for Medicaid redesign in our state. And it became quite clear that there were a lot of sort of guiding principles that are included on the left-hand side of the screen. And then we also included another graphic representation of that vision, really showing that we need to coordinate care not only horizontally across levels of care, but also vertically, so that we're really integrating care as much as we possibly can to make sure Alaskans are getting the best health care possible. So today I'm going to just kind of go through pretty quickly the 16 different initiatives. There's a lot of work happening. One of the things we first did is we really laid out what reforms needed to happen first and what sort of teed up other reforms. So for our primary care case management and health homes initiative, we really wanted the coordinated care demonstration projects, probably one of our two biggest reforms included in SB 74, which I'll touch on momentarily, to have a chance to ramp up and start serving Alaskans. But we also wanted to ramp up some, in the meantime, some temporary case management services for Medicaid recipients. So what we did is we expanded our Alaska Medicaid Coordinated Care Initiative, AMCCI, which you might know by its tagline, Super Utilizer Program, for those that go to the emergency room 5 or more times in a year. And we worked with that contractor to expand those services. And they've been reaching out. We provide that contractor with a list of about 20 to 30,000 names. And we reach out to those Medicaid recipients and offer them case management services. And as we reach out to them, we also ask if they have other family members that are receiving Medicaid or Denali Kid Care benefits. And we offer those same case management services to help them better navigate the healthcare delivery system here in our state. The other part of the case management initiative are health homes. Health homes are sort of a specific program listed in Section 1945 of the Affordable Care Act, and also sort of letting the coordinated care demonstration projects roll out, as well as our behavioral health reform. We planned for health home rollout in 2018, and we will start planning that pretty quickly here, because there is a pretty long process through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, because you actually get an enhanced federal match for those recipients participating in a health home program. Typically, for your adult receiving Medicaid in our state, we have a 50-50 match. There's other federal matches depending on what program you are, or if you're a Indian Health Service beneficiary getting your care at a tribal health facility. But using that 50-50 model, the health home model allows us to get a higher federal match for the first 8 quarters a health home program is implemented. And we have a lot of flexibility in how we roll out health homes. We can look at different regions of the state. We can look at Medicaid recipients that have specific health care needs, really looking at Alaskans that maybe have behavioral health needs and chronic physical health needs. So health homes will be something that we will be ramping up with our key partners to see exactly how we roll those out.
Sure, Ms. Martin. Representative Sullivan Leonard has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. Is health homes referred to as a home health care? I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with this, so I'm wondering if it's home health care.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, it's a health home. Can be a primary care setting, mm-hmm. but it can also be perhaps a behavioral health clinic that is providing services. So it's not necessarily home health care, but perhaps home health care services could be provided as part of that. It's really designed to allow some flexibility to see how we can best suit the healthcare needs of that individual. And in Oregon is a state that implemented health homes. And one of the examples they used is they have had an elderly woman that in the summer months went to the emergency room a lot. And they found out that in the hot summer months, it must be in Eastern Oregon, having lived in Portland, in Eastern Oregon it gets pretty hot. So they found that by purchasing her a window air conditioning unit, and dropping the temperature in her apartment, they were almost instantly able to reduce the number of emergency room visits she had. And by that, then they reduced healthcare costs, and a $300 to $500 window AC unit actually helped them save quite a bit more money. So it really gives providers the ability to provide care a little bit differently to really get down to the issues that are causing the healthcare needs.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Thank you, Representative Sullivan Leonard. To be clear, so the health home project, which will be rolled out, is aimed to get patients who are emergency room users connected with the right kind of medical care that will be A, better for them, and B, cheaper. Is that fair to say?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That's one of the ways health homes could be implemented. It could also be through providers that see a need, maybe for behavioral health clients with behavioral health needs that they need to address, to really start managing behavioral health needs, primary care needs. It really offers a lot of flexibility to set up different programs. So it could be emergency room usage, most definitely, as well as a lot of other things where providers see a need. And I'm sorry, the commissioner reminded me the enhanced federal match, as I mentioned, is actually 90% federal, 10% state, and that's for the first 8 quarters of a program rollout.
Thank you. And then also we've got a committee alternate, Representative Sadler. Did you have a question, Representative Sadler?
I appreciate the chance to participate. Yeah, briefly, Monique, I'll put in the form of a question. Is health home also considered a patient-centered medical home? Is that a term that's often used in parallel?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, patient-centered medical home is another designation and doesn't come along with that enhanced federal match of the 90-10.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, we probably have two of our bigger reforms in SB 74, and this is the first one, our behavioral health system reform. And this is truly comprehensive behavioral health reform, really looking at identifying the gaps in the continuum of care that we have in our behavioral health system in Alaska. An important partnership we have in this program is with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. They have been a crucial partner for the department, not only for this reform specifically, but for the larger reform efforts underway. The trustees for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority awarded just about $10 million for the first 3 years of implementation of SB 74 to cover various things from stakeholder engagement that we have underway with AgNewBeck to actuarial consulting services that we need for the 1115 waiver for behavioral health. And without their funding, really we see it was crucial to make us be successful in rolling out these reforms. So specifically for the behavioral health system reform, one of our biggest milestones is submitting a Section 1115 waiver to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And this is really going to provide us some flexibility in how we provide Medicaid services and potentially how we pay for Medicaid services. And really moving from paying for volume to paying for value in our behavioral health system. We have recently submitted on January 4th a waiver concept paper to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which was a big sort of initial step to submit our 1115 waiver ultimately, which we plan to do in July. We've already started conversations pretty much right after that paper dropped with staff from CMS to get the ball rolling, and it's moving quickly. I think one of the important things to note on this one is we also have six public-private teams working on various aspects of the waiver application. An 1115 waiver application is lots of requirements from CMS on things we need to sort of check off the list as we move forward with that application. It will be quite a technical process. One of the big pieces of an 1115 waiver is showing budget neutrality for the federal government, that the program we ultimately institute can't cost the feds more than what it costs them now for us to provide these behavioral health services. So we contracted with Milliman, who is helping us not only with the behavioral health redesign, but also our coordinated care demonstration project. Health homes there will help us with later. And really we sort of combined these pools of funding to bring Milliman on because we thought we would be best suited by having one actuarial firm help us with all these reform efforts so that we work with one firm that really gets to know Alaska.
Ms. Martin, I think we'll, unless members have questions, we'll trust your work on trying to achieve the 1115 waiver. Last year, the 1115 waiver was discussed quite a bit. Just as quickly as you can you explain what the 1115 waiver is and how it leverages extra federal funds?
Mr. Chair, an 1115 waiver is a waiver of certain requirements of the Social Security Act. The 1115 waiver in this instance must show budget neutrality. So we basically negotiate with the federal government terms of being able to provide health care differently in our state. And so the things that we're looking at include improving our improving our outcome measures. We're looking at improving in five distinct areas. One, expanding our treatment capacity and improving access to services. The second is doing better integration of care, and not only just between primary care and behavioral health, but also integration of care in different settings. Really looking at integrating some social supports that we know help people to be successful. That has been the experience of other states. The third, cost and outcomes reform. Fourth is provider payment and accountability reform, as Ms. Martin mentioned earlier. And then the fifth is delivery system reform.
Commissioner, this is the one that would allow you to get Medicaid funding also at larger facilities than we can get Medicaid coverage for now. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. So the way that CMS, or Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, really set up a two-step process for us to be able to waive the institutions for mental disease limitation. The IMD exclusion has been around for quite some time, and if you are a facility that has 16 beds or more, or, sorry, more than 16 beds, you cannot bill Medicaid for treatment services, which is a problem for our state, because when that rule went into effect, we actually had larger treatment facilities. We're a small state. Folks wanted to be able to maximize economy of scale, be able to reduce admin costs, heating costs, etc. And unfortunately, when that IMD exclusion went in, Alaska was really disproportionately impacted.
And then,
so the 1115 waiver here, getting back to your question, I apologize. CMS has said they are willing to waive that requirement if a state first does an 1115 waiver, and they will allow us to amend that waiver to be able to waive the IMD exclusion. And these waivers are for five-year time periods, but they can be renewed, and they renew often.
And then just quickly, Commissioner, talking about adding the social supports to transition people sort of out of the system and back into the community, some of that will be covered also by Medicaid if you succeed at this, and then will this then become something better than a 50-50 match rate if it's accepted?
Mr. Chair, under the terms of the 1115 waiver, we will basically be reimbursed at the appropriate level for however the person qualifies. So if the person is we're participating in the 1115 program and they are eligible for Medicaid under Medicaid expansion, that will be covered under that enhanced rate. If it's for regular adult with no other special conditions, then it will be at 50%. So it doesn't necessarily change the enhancement of the rate. What it does allow us to do is to be able to use design our programs a little more creatively than current federal Medicaid rules allow, which will allow us to be able to achieve those savings.
Including the supports, coverage for the supports?
Yes, I'm sorry, including supports.
All right. Okay, go on, please. Thank you.
As part of the behavioral health system reform, the department will also be contracting with an administrative services organization to really help support the department, and particularly the Division of Behavioral Health, in sort of this new system that we're developing with the 1115 waiver. Our next big steps are the release of a request for information on an administrative services organization. This will allow us to gauge the interest in providing these services for the Department of Health and Social Services. And also, it gives us a chance to ask some questions that will help us kind of really flesh out the request for proposals, which we plan to release in the summer. And then we would award that contract in January of 2018. This really will help the Division of Behavioral Health Services move from managing the contracts that we have with different grantees and providers into really analyzing data that's provided by the Administrative Services Organization, identify areas where we might see potential gaps sort of resurfacing as we develop our new system of care, and we'll really move into the policy development, working constantly to identify gaps, what services do we need to provide Alaskans, what services maybe are we providing that really aren't being taken advantage of, or maybe there's just a lesser need than we thought. So it'll allow us to be a little bit more agile in identifying those needs before they become a problem for Alaskans. The second of our two big reforms is the coordinated care demonstration projects. And this will allow the department to test some new delivery system and payment reform models for our Medicaid program. There are some specific measures that the coordinated care demonstration projects have to include. As sort of to bring you up to date on where we've been, we released a request for information similar to the one that I mentioned for the Administrative Services Organization, really to, again, gauge the interest in what people might be thinking about in our state, different providers that are already here, or maybe some of the national organizations that provide case management services. We received 12 responses back, and really they range from regional accountable care type models of care to statewide full risk managed care. Those who responded to the request for information are not required to submit a proposal ultimately when we release the RFP. And just because an organization or provider group did not submit an RFI, that does not mean they are excluded from applying for an RFP to the RFP, the request for proposals ultimately. We found out about some funding opportunities through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, who purchased technical assistance on behalf of the state of Alaska with Pacific Health Policy Group. This is a new line of business for the Department of Health and Social Services, and we really felt like we would benefit from some technical assistance as we move through this process. PHPG, Pacific Health Policy Group, came to town, spent 2 days with us, met with leadership, and then they met with a bunch of the Medicaid directors and lead staff, and we spent about 4 hours talking through what does our system of care look like now, what are the things that we should be considering, and really it helped inform PHPG about Alaska a little bit and helped the department be more informed about this RFP process and really moving through a coordinated care demonstration project. As required by Senate Bill 74, we were supposed to release our RFP by December 31st of 2016, and we did on December 30th. We anticipate a pretty intensive proposal evaluation as we move through this process. There's a pretty extensive requirement for anyone replying to the RFP regarding what does their
program. Ms. Martin, if it's okay with the committee and you, I think the committee might be more interested in what, once it's up and going, what it will do. I don't think we need as much to know who you hired or about the RFP process. So what will the project do and whether it's started or hasn't started? And in this one, it hasn't started, right? So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's correct. It hasn't started yet. What the proposals, what the coordinated care demonstration projects could do are just about anything someone might propose in terms of perhaps providing case management services to more costly portions of the Medicaid program. They may look to take on delivering care to all Medicaid recipients in a specific part of the state, either regionally or even statewide. These proposals really could take on a little bit of any different kind of healthcare delivery model and really allowing what providers in a specific region see as a healthcare delivery model that would work best in their part of the state or for the residents, Medicaid residents that they serve.
All right, thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chair, add just a little bit, a comment here. One of the things that the legislature did, and specifically Senator Kelly, who was the sponsor of this bill, really did a really nice job of making sure that the department had broad reform authority. And I think one of the best things that this bill did was really provide the department with broad reform authority to be able to go out and test, work with providers, work with communities to really test new models. So that every time there is a new innovation that is happening at the national level with CMS, for example, it seems like every year or so there is a new alphabet soup acronym of a new way to deliver healthcare that's better, faster, smarter, etc. And sometimes it has been challenging for the department to be able to pursue those opportunities without that authority. And so the great thing about Senate Bill 74 is it provided the department with broad authority. And as Ms. Martin said, we really received all kinds of proposals to be able to do all kinds of things, and they were very they were very forthright with us in the kinds of information that they provided. They shared very confidential business information and business modeling with us. One of the things that we agreed to do is, and they would ask, okay, we're about to give you our trade secrets. We just want to make sure that that isn't going to be shared far and wide with the state, which is why the evaluation and the summary documents were provided that will allow us to be able to move forward with the RFP. So let me take a little bit of a step back, recognizing that we as a department haven't really done this kind of work before. One of the things we recognized early on is we needed to bring some national experts to the state to help us with what is within the range of possibilities that other states are doing. One of the things that they encouraged us to do was to do a request for information from potential folks who are potentially interested before we use that information to refine the RFP process. Because quite frankly, if we hadn't done that first, I'm not sure that we would have been able to manage, well, just be honest, managing that level of change would have been challenging and perhaps problematic.
Thank you, Commissioner. So, Commissioner, Senate Bill 74, it was a massive bill, and and we passed it. So we told you what you had to do, and I think the committee has trust that you're applying to get those things underway. I think probably if we could focus more on not the upcoming programs that you're applying for, mm-hmm. but the reforms that have been adopted or the costs, benefits, savings, and results of things that are ongoing in Medicaid expansion and reform, the things that are happening now as opposed to the ones that you're applying for, that might help the committee more, because we're definitely not going to criticize you for following through on SB 74, but a lot of the application requirements are going to take time. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, it does. If I can offer one alternative.
Yeah, you're allowed to do that.
Thank you. As we're moving forward with implementing Senate Bill 74, one of the things that we have encountered when we're talking to the public is, why isn't this done already? Why aren't you moving faster? And as the bill was moving its way through the legislature, there was some pretty honest conversation about what the appropriate timelines were and what we thought we would be able to pull off as a state, not only within our capacity at the department, but also at the community level and at the provider level. And so what we have been trying to do today, and perhaps spending too much time on the step-by-step, is to let you know what the timelines were that we are required to meet and our progress and how we are getting there. So maybe we'll try not to do as much of that as we move forward.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. Unless other people are concerned, obviously you were very clear about that last year. Yeah. And so I think the committee does want to know the sort of health care that's being provided through reform or expansion, costs, benefits, things that we're able to do now that we weren't able to do, federal money leverage, that sort of stuff.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
The next option that we, one of the initiatives in SB 74 are implementation of the 1915 I and K options. These are home and community-based services designed to keep Alaskans in their homes and make sure they're getting the services they need so that they can stay there safely. And we offer these in alternative to required Medicaid services, mandatory services of nursing level of care. So instead of people being in nursing homes, we can provide services designed to keep them in their home at a lower cost and places probably where they'd much prefer to be. This is going to allow us to get an enhanced federal match. Some programs we offer are paid for with 100% general fund dollars. And 1915 I and K options will allow us to get a 50-50 match for some. Other services we offer, we get a 50-50 split with the feds. They pay half the bill, we pay the other. And we'll be able to get an enhanced match, a bump of 6%, where the federal government will pay 56%, and then the state will pay 44% of those costs. The final report was issued. There's a link on here if you would like to take a look. One of the things that was really important for the department is that we not implement a program that becomes mandatory. 1915 I and K options are entitlement programs, so if we offer them, we can't create a wait list to really set caps and ensure that we're staying within budget. So to make sure, one of the department's recommendations from the Contractor Health Management Associates was to move forward with 1915K options, those for Alaskans that meet a nursing level of care, but not move forward with the 1915I option. We are still confident in the savings we can achieve outlined in SB 74. Senior and Disability Services is putting together some numbers for us to make sure we're on track. But that's one of those that we'll be looking at really closely to ensure that we're able to meet those requirements and the numbers of savings that we said we would achieve in SB 74. So we will provide more information as that comes available, if the committee would like, on what the differences in services, and really it may be pursuing a different type of waiver. So that's something that will be more coming soon as work progresses.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. I forgot to mention that this whole presentation is uploaded and it's up on BASIS. Commissioner, Ms. Martin, are you able to just give us one example of, just give us an example of something the state is paying for in terms of institutional level of care, 100%, that if we achieve this waiver, we'll get federal funding for?
Mr. Chair, can you repeat the question?
Sure. Can you give an example of a kind of service that right now the state is paying for that if we achieve the waiver approval will qualify for federal matching funds?
So for home and community-based services, those kinds of services include chore services. They include assistance with activities of daily living. In some instances, we are actually paying for under 1915K, we have a 50% match. Under regular Medicaid, under 1915K, we will get enhanced match of 56%. We were hopeful that we would be able to move forward with a 1915I option that would allow us to be able to move certain services, certain behavioral health services, from 100% general fund to 50% general fund. But as we worked with our contractor HMA to look at our level of service, our level of need, we don't think that doing it under the 1915I option is feasible for our state at this time.
Thank you.
So one of the things, if I may, on that point, as we are moving forward, one of the things that we have been really, really careful about is, as we're moving forward, we think that some things may seem like a great idea at the time. Perhaps things change. Making sure that we drill down and get the information, do the actuarial analysis, meet with those national experts who can do a deep dive on what's happening in Alaska to really make any adjustments that we think are necessary to be able to make the decision about when we move forward and when we don't. So the 1915K is an example. That one makes sense to move forward with. The other program that we were looking at, 1915I, was not feasible for the state at this time, and we're looking at other options to be able to provide that service.
Thank you.
They're not specifically called out in Senate Bill 74. We have a work group related to SB 91. Implementation and integration with the efforts ongoing in the reforms in Senate Bill 74. And though the Department of Corrections is really the lead agency when it comes to SB 91, the Criminal Justice Reform Bill, there's a pretty big role for the Department of Health and Social Services. And there's a list here of some of those reforms that are being made at DHSS. But we also have a work group that meets the last Monday of every month, and really looking at how we maximize enrollment for those who are about to be released from a correctional facility, in not only Medicaid programs, but other programs that they might qualify for, to make sure people have the tools they need to be successful when they're released from a correctional facility.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. I had two questions, probably from page 9, Representative Johnston, and then Representative Tarr.
Yes, thank you very much, through the chair. I appreciate you doing the deep dive between the I and K. I was just curious if both these programs, are these long-standing programs, or have they been relatively new?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, 1915I and 1915K options are actually were made available through the passage of the Affordable Care Act, or with the Recovery Act.
Affordable Care Act?
Recovery Act.
K, Affordable Care Act.
I believe, was the Recovery Act amended
from
the Affordable Care Act.
Can you repeat that for the record?
Yes, please.
K was through the Affordable Care Act. I was through the through ERA, the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act. Thank you. I always forget the A. But there were also enhancements that were made through the Affordable Care Act.
Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was actually on the criminal justice reform piece of this, and because pieces are being slowly implemented, I'm just curious sort of if you're seeing any increase in the number of people in terms of the workload you have for helping people apply for services upon release. And then, are those individuals like more likely to be in traditional Medicaid or expansion? Because I guess when they come out, they would be considered as a zero-income individual. Is that true?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, most of the folks who are released are eligible for Medicaid expansion. And one of the things that other states know, we have learned from other states through other reducing recidivism efforts, is if you have someone who is released who has an appointment within that same week or a very short time period with a behavioral health provider they can go to an appointment and they can work with immediately, if they have access to supports, we significantly reduce their level of recidivism. So we really see criminal justice reform as an opportunity to either build healthier Alaskans or build more prisons. Mm-hmm. We don't have the resources to build more prisons, so we are working with the Department of Corrections to really build healthier Alaskans. Because what's happening right now, unfortunately, in some correctional institutions is they do have some treatment, they do have some services there, and then once they are released, they don't necessarily have access to those services.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thank you.
Proceed. Thanks.
The next initiative in SB 74 is the Emergency Department Care Improvement Initiative, and the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association is called out as the lead agency in SB 74. Their work has been progressing quite quickly. They have identified a real-time information exchange designed to help those super utilizers of emergency rooms connect more appropriately to primary care services. That information exchange is also designed to identify those who are maybe seeking prescription drugs. So the work group with ASHNA, the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and the emergency physicians has been moving pretty quickly. Another big piece besides the information exchange is some guidelines for prescribing narcotics. The work group came together and drafted these guidelines for prescribing narcotics. The final version of those guidelines have been distributed to hospitals for sign-off. And this is really an important tool to help us in Alaska to really reduce our opioid abuse in Alaska. So that will be one. There's a lot of doctors already involved in that work group to help with the guidelines, and as hospitals sign off, then those guidelines will be implemented in emergency rooms. As far as savings in SB 74, how this program helps with that is reducing the number of Alaskans perhaps inappropriately using the emergency room. And Ashton is quite confident in how they can help us reduce emergency room usage and reduce our costs and really connect Alaskans with more appropriate primary care services.
Ms. Martin, Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Martin, how binding are the guidelines? The governor has announced an opioid task force. I know that the PDMP was strengthened in SB 74. The guidelines, are they going to be binding on physicians? Or speak a little bit more about that, if you would. If you can.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I'm not as familiar with the guidelines.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, and as the governor mentioned in his State of the State, he is really interested in pursuing enhancements to our opioid strategy in Alaska based upon the recommendations of the Opioid Policy Task Force. I think some of those may require some legislative changes. Some of them I think we can implement in other ways, but this is the list of five. Sometimes I think it's handy that we have five fingers. One is to be able to limit the amount of pills that a doctor can prescribe with some exceptions. So if I need to have a root canal, is it
Commissioner Davidson, just okay. Representative Sadler just asked you a question that you're going to be called back to the standing committee to address at a later meeting.
Okay.
And I think probably that'll be we don't want to keep pushing you in a different area, so
okay.
I'll have you continue with your presentation.
So, Mr. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, stay tuned.
Yeah. Is that okay, Representative Sadler? Later meeting?
We'll have to go through here.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, through the chair. As far as the emergency room usage, do you have any way to track the usage this year and last year so that as you go forward, what these reforms will do? I mean, I understand nationally with the Medicaid expansion, the usage of ER has gone up, but it's been compensated to the hospitals because it's now being paid. So I know that wasn't the policy that we were trying to get to. So could you, do you have ways of tracking the usage?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes, we do. One of the things that is a requirement of this public-private partnership is tracking the change that occurs once this program is implemented, as well as every year, because there is also in the legislation an opportunity to be able to share in the savings.
So, through the chair, you will have the statistics from last year and this year and then see going forward.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, let me parse that out in two ways. For this particular project, which is a public health public-private partnership with ASHNA, this project has not begun yet. They are in the planning and implementation phase. There is another project that the department has taken on that was a voluntary program where we looked at super utilizers and matched them up with a care coordinator on the phone who was able to work with them to be able to get them a primary care appointment, etc. We, as a result of Senate Bill 74, have increased that activity, and we are tracking that information because clearly we want to know that we're making a difference, and we can provide that information to the committee as that information becomes available.
Thank you.
And Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And not to get back on the opioid task force, but number one and two of those 5 points were addressed in Senate Bill 74. So when we do have that conversation, what I wanted to understand better is how what the numbers one and two interacted with the provisions that were already in Senate Bill 74. And then just a question relative to Representative Johnston's question. I know because the super utilizers, I have a large number of them in my district, so this has been an issue I've watched. I think you do have that, and that has shown a dramatic decrease from that original project. And so that I just want to make sure we did get that out there that so far it's been very successful.
And then just to the members, as we go through this in the next few meetings, if you do have budget questions, feel free to ask them, obviously, to budget questions related to the programs that the commissioner is going through. Thank you, Commissioner.
So before we go on, one of the things Ms. Martin mentioned in the previous slide, criminal justice reform, as we're moving forward with these various reform initiatives, one of the things that we have tried to be very intentional about is making sure that as the work is happening in criminal justice reform and the work that's happening in these other areas, they're not happening separately, so that we don't make a change here that impacts another opportunity somewhere else. So there's a lot of integration happening just to make sure that one group doesn't accidentally do something that causes a problem for another. We have monthly meetings in which we have report outs to make sure that as we are moving forward that doesn't occur. And then we also have bumblebee cross-pollinization, where we have folks on a number of different of these work groups to make sure that we raise issues, because I think sometimes when folks are feeling like they're under the gun and they need to get things done quickly, sometimes we have to be reminded to stop and take a look up and make sure that we're not unintentionally causing a problem for someone else.
Commissioner, we're going to try and adjourn the meeting by 5. One of the things I think I know the committee wants to hear about is what the department is doing on Medicaid expansion, what services are being provided that weren't being provided before, what federal funding we're leveraging that we weren't leveraging before. The SB 74 reforms that we haven't started yet, I think I'll just let the committee know that was a two-week debate on House Finance last year, and we probably don't have the time in the subcommittee to go through that bill as much as maybe some people would want, but I know the department's available to talk to folks if they'd like to know.
Okay,
thanks.
So if I may cover these next few slides without sounding like an auctioneer, there is a telehealth work group that will do some of the same things we talked about before, but in the focus area of telehealth. Is that too brief? Am I making you uncomfortable? Okay. They're really happy. These are the work group members, and obviously we're happy to have conversations with any folks offline to be able to provide more detail. The other is we know that we have some gaps also in our health information infrastructure, and have engaged a company to help us to be able to get where we need to be so that we can make better data-informed decisions to make better health policy decisions as a state.
Mr. Chair.
And these are funded at 90% match.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Sullivan Leonard has a question.
Thanks. I'll make it quick. With regard to the telehealth development, have you seen an increase in users then with regard to utilization of the telehealth system?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, we have certainly seen, I know in my background as well as Ms. Martin's background, we came from tribal health,
right.
And there is a lot of a huge significant increase in the utilization of telehealth as that equipment and technology became more available. They, as a participant of the Alaska Federal Healthcare Access Network, were able to provide, receive funding for that equipment and for those facilities. However, there has not necessarily been that level of growth in the non-tribal system. And so, and there were actually some limitations in our state law that did not allow provider or telehealth to really exist to the extent that our state would like to see. In a state as large as ours, where there may be a limited number of providers or maybe no specialists in a community, it does allow us to be able to extend the level of care without also increasing those travel costs. in the tribal health system. I know that they have done some studies where they have tracked the number of encounters that have resulted in reduced travel that have been very helpful.
Okay.
In some cases, it has increased travel because you know, what you see is clearly maybe not necessarily be what somebody has described, but overall it has resulted in more savings than expenditures. Slide 15, the tribal claiming policy. This was new guidance that we received from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I spoke about this the other day a little bit, and it really extends services through tribal and non-tribal partnerships under certain circumstances, as long as certain requirements are met. We continue to negotiate and meet with and bring folks together, tribal and non-tribal providers, to be able to negotiate those care coordination agreements, as well as our state plan amendments with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Commissioner, on tribal claiming and then getting the 100% Medicaid coverage, so there have been some entities that are able to do this now, but the other entities that you've targeted as potential recipients haven't completed their negotiations. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Thank you. So
in our first year, we were actually trying to focus most of our effort on travel. Unfortunately, we encountered a little bit of a snag with our negotiations with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, where they said, so emergency travel is covered at 100%. Non-emergent travel is also covered. It has to be medically necessary. But where we have encountered a hiccup is for other kinds of ancillary travel services. So, for example, taxi cab vouchers, as well as accommodation services. The guidance that CMS wanted to provide, but their Office of General Counsel would not allow them to provide, is they said that the tribal health organizations had to have care coordination agreements with every independent cab company, every independent lodging and hotel company, and provide them with confidential patient information that would satisfy the care coordination agreement. We pushed back and said, you know, I'm pretty sure that's a HIPAA violation. We're not really allowed to encourage that activity. They said we understand, and we are working through that to provide a minimum level of data set that will allow them to meet their care coordination requirements without us violating HIPAA, because I don't think I would want the last cab I took to know things about me that I'm not willing to share. So in that light, we're not achieving those savings in travel at the rate we thought we were going to be able to. So we have now turned our efforts to other areas, and quite frankly, we are looking at high-dollar, low-volume services. In order to do that data match between IHS beneficiaries and Medicaid beneficiaries, it is not as easy of a data match as you might think it is, because our federal requirements are a little bit different for our Medicaid requirements, and so we're trying to work smarter and harder to try to achieve those savings in other areas. So we will be rolling out those agreements, arranging lots of meetings, lots of first dates, second dates, third dates to try to make the love happen, so that we can both extend a level of services that are available, reduce some of that duplication that might occur, and also save the state general fund dollars.
Thank you, Commissioner. Question by Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, one of the sort of criticisms or reasons people are sometimes critical on the travel costs is what happens in the case of canceled appointments. And I don't have a good understanding of how frequently that happens or what the cost impact, or does that leave Medicaid on the hook, for example, if you have an appointment that you don't cancel within 24 hours, you know, which is something I've had before, then there's, you know, like a minimum charge. I don't expect that you maybe are prepared to discuss those items today, but just when we get to that, I think that would be something, you know, maybe that's, and maybe it's not even true that that's a big problem. It may be a perception issue, and I guess that's what I want to understand better, and if there's anything we could do to try and make that a more sort of effective system. I know you talked about co-scheduling appointments with family members. That sounds like an excellent opportunity, and so any additional information would be helpful.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, predominantly the reason for missed appointments for travel is Alaska weather.
Okay.
So we may have, let's say my mother's home village, Guilinuk, we may have an elder who needs to come in to Anchorage for an appointment with a cardiologist at ANMC. That person makes it into Bethel, but the weather is bad in Bethel, and they never make it to Anchorage. Mm. The flight is on delay. It's on weather hold. The flight gets pushed back until 11 p.m., and then it's finally canceled at midnight or 12:01, same day. So that appointment isn't able to be canceled within the time period, etc. So one of the benefits of the tribal claiming policy is a number of the tribal health organizations have expressed interest in taking over that travel piece. Mm. So, for example, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is doing it now. I think the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation is interested. They're all interested. It's just a question of when they're going to do it. When folks are in Bethel, YKHC has a better sense of what the weather is in Guiginok or Kipnuk or Gengenuk, or I shouldn't pick all coastal villages because I'll get myself in trouble at home, or the upriver villages of Aniak, Kalskeg, Joachbalak, and Middle Kuskokwim villages. They have a better sense of what those weather delays are, and they are in a much better position to be able to reschedule those appointments if they know that they're having a weather delay. So we anticipate that certainly something that I saw when I worked in tribal health is the more if you can provide care as close to home as possible, you have much better outcomes, and that is also true for travel.
Commissioner, I think I could be very wrong, but I think people are going to have questions on Medicaid expansion, what we're spending, what we're achieving. So if you could maybe skip through the things that we haven't started doing yet, and
okay.
Though I don't want you to skip the fraud. The fraud slide, just in the event that you've started to implement anything more in the area of fraud prevention.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Included in SB 74 was legislation to create the Alaska Medicaid False Claim and Reporting Act. And this does a variety of things for the department. It allows us to assess interest and penalties on any identified overpayments. It also has two self-audits required every 2 years, and those audits, as overpayments are identified, they can be reported back at no penalty to the provider if they identify anything, any errors. The first report to the legislature, the Fraud, Abuse, and Waste Payment and Eligibility Errors Report, it was presented to the legislature on November 15th. That was our first report. And progress is continuing at the department. We have a interdepartment committee looking at all things that need to be included in the act. And nearing completion are our first set of regulations related to audit and provider record keeping. So those will be coming soon for public comment.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. And Representative Leonard asked me a question. I just want to put what I meant to say was, in the budget subcommittee, we probably don't need to go through the things that you're not doing yet that SB 24 requires, but we do want to know the things that you are doing that you wish to address. But obviously, Medicaid expansion will be one of them. But we're trying to skip through the things that you haven't started yet that you're required to deal with under SB 74.
Mr. Chair, if I may, one that has been getting a lot of attention are the privatization reports. And as a reminder for the committee, we will be transmitting those reports to the legislature tomorrow.
I will touch on one thing that we've been asked a lot A lot of questions from the public. Department of Administration is the lead agency on a healthcare authority study, looking at the feasibility of creating a healthcare authority. Other states have. Washington State has one. Oregon has one. And they are going to be issuing their first report, their preliminary report in February, and their second report in July. We would like to make sure that folks know that you can sign up for email updates and public meeting announcements. If you go to the Healthy Alaska page, which you can see there, we've been telling folks before the holidays that if instead of watching a Netflix series-a-thon, you can go on the website and watch the Healthy Alaska Medicaid Redesign webinar series. It's exciting stuff. So one of the things that the department has really undertaken has really been about providing more transparency. We publish this report at the close of every month, and this is the latest report through December 28th of 2016. That report is on our website at dhss.alaska.gov, and if you click on the link, it'll take you right to this page. What this information shows is the number of through December 2016, 27,415 Alaskans have been enrolled in Medicaid expansion. To the right, you can see how many are in which age demographic. So how many folks are 19 to 34, how many are 35 to 44, 45 to 54, and 55 to 64. You can see that more men, 15,560 are men versus 11,855 are women. Medicaid expansion in our state began on September 1st, 2015. So after a little bit over a year of time, 27,415 Alaskans have enrolled in Medicaid expansion.
Commissioner, you'll get to it, obviously, because it's the next thing on this part of the slide, but the $316 million figure of services that have been provided on this page, so far, those have been covered under the Medicaid expansion rate, right? That's not all. That's not general fund dollars, I take it?
Mr. Chair, as you can see in this chart, the $316.3 million in claims that have been paid through December of 2016 have been at 100% federal match. So one of the things that I have really appreciated about Medicaid expansion is that's $316 million in new federal revenues into our economy that, quite frankly, at a time that our economy really needed the boost. The thing that I also appreciate about Medicaid expansion is that whenever we roll out economic development programs, they're typically large projects. They involve infrastructure. I think one of the challenges is it is sometimes those economic benefits don't necessarily get dispersed throughout the state into the small communities. Medicaid expansion, those resources go to every community in which healthcare is provided. So if you are if you're a community health aide, you're a village of 300 people and you are receiving your care through a community health aid, those dollars go back to that community. Pretty significant economic boost, not only for the larger urban centers, but also in the smallest of our communities.
Commissioner, before I get to a question by Representative Sadler, just brief background for folks who weren't here last year, Medicaid expansion covers people up to what income limit, and then you don't have to have children or anything like that to be a Medicaid expansion enrollee, right? Just if you could just talk about the population that's being served by this just a little bit.
Sure. Under Medicaid expansion, Medicaid expansion covers adults without dependent children between the ages of 19 and 64, who have incomes of about $20,000 for a single Alaskan. People who are over 64, who are 65, are covered under Medicare. You are not eligible for Medicaid expansion if you are 65. You're also not eligible for Medicaid expansion if you are under 19. So the way that Medicaid expansion is reimbursed is under the Affordable Care Act, in the first hard calendar year, through the first three hard calendar years, starting in calendar year 2014 and continuing through 2016, those first 3 years are 100% federal match. Unfortunately, those were not rolling calendar years. Often in federal legislation, when you make those kinds of changes, those are rolling years. And so you would get, if we had three rolling years, we would have the benefit of 3 years of 100% federal match. But that is not the way that this law was written. It was 100% federal match through December of 2016. Starting in January, calendar year 2017, the federal match is 94%. 2018, the match is 95%. Starting 18 is 94%. Starting calendar year 19, that match is 93%. And then in the year 2020 and beyond, as written in the Affordable Care Act, that match is 90%.
Thank you, Commissioner. And then if I miss anybody, if like you raise your hand and I don't see you, you can feel free to say something in the microphone, like say whatever you want that's nice, right? Representative Sullivan Leonard and Representative Sadler had questions.
Who do you want to start with?
I'll start with you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, or through the chair, excuse me. Commissioner, could you please go back to page 18 for me? Part of the component, I think, for the Medicaid expansion certainly does look at the prescription drug monitoring program. Could you give me a quick overview on that, please?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, the prescription drug monitoring program is a program within the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. It's actually managed by the Board of Pharmacy. And it requires providers to be able to submit data that really documents and keeps track of certain kinds of prescription drugs, including prescription opioids. Until Senate Bill 74, providers were only required to report monthly, and as a result of feedback we certainly heard from Alaskans, folks could do a whole lot of pill shopping in a month, and thought that time period needed to be tightened. And so providers have to submit that data on a weekly basis. There are some exemptions. So for example, if somebody is in hospice or they're receiving end-of-life care, then it doesn't necessarily make sense to do that. But really the whole point of the prescription drug monitoring program is to really capture that data so that we can reduce the number of folks who are inappropriately pill shopping.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And that wasn't part of Medicaid expansion, but that was an offshoot of SB 74, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Representative Sadler, did you still have a question?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Commissioner Davidson. You had mentioned one of the benefits, the claim for Medicaid expansion, is it was going to boost the economy. To what extent did the Medicaid expansion last year boost the economy? I saw a report recently that the state had entered a recession in 2016. Was Medicaid expansion enough to address that or to reverse that?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, can you ask your question again?
Certainly.
Can I try and let me know if I get this wrong? We've lost jobs in the state, roughly 7,000. We've been warned that was coming. We've cut the budget by somewhere over $2 billion. We were told that would have some impact on the economy. I think Representative Sadler wants to know, can you quantify what has been added by Medicaid expansion to the economy, if you can, in terms of jobs?
through the, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, or through the chair, Representative Sadler, both of you. Mm-hmm. So based upon the information that was provided by, can I get back to you on that number? I'm sorry, I don't have that number off the top of my head.
Sure, Commissioner. Representative Sadler, is that okay?
Sure. Yeah, just.
So we did hear from the Department of Labor as they were looking and doing their latest economic report. They did report that healthcare was the bright spot in Alaska's economy. And so we can provide you more information. Okay. I'm sorry, I don't have it here with me today. You can see.
I'm sorry, go ahead, ma'am.
Yeah. You can see to the right, we also thought it would be helpful to the right, this pie chart. Excuse me. Since folks are often interested in have all kinds of questions about Medicaid, we also thought it would be helpful to provide more Medicaid information beyond just Medicaid expansion. So you can see the chart on the right, the pie chart on the right-hand side shows the percentage of Medicaid enrollees by category. You can see that children under regular Children's Health Insurance Program, or Denali KidCare as we call it in our state, as well as children who live with disabilities, make up half of our Medicaid population through December of 2016. The expansion population represents 16%. Seniors represent 5%. Parent caretakers represent 20%. And then adults who live with disabilities comprise 8%. The map, it doesn't show up very well on the screen. Hopefully you can see it better on your printed copy, shows a geographic representation for where Medicaid beneficiaries or enrollees live. And we have broken it out both by all Medicaid and then just expansion only.
Commissioner, and if we skip the slide that somebody wants more information on, just ask me and we'll ask the commissioner to go back to it. Commissioner, the one thing that sticks out for me on Medicaid expansion, if you can explain it to me and the others, is you've often talked about behavioral health parity under Medicaid expansion, which I assume means that other services come that weren't being provided before. What does that mean, and what's the impact been so far?
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that one of the biggest beneficiaries, one of the biggest benefits that Medicaid expansion has provided in Alaska is another payer for behavioral health services. And I think so far the number of behavioral health claims that have been paid out has been about a little under $20 million. I think it's about $19 million. In claims that have been paid. And so one of the things that happens is, let me take a step back and say it this way. Behavioral health providers, like everybody else, to some degree, they have to operate, they have to be able to operate like a business. They can only provide a certain amount of charity care. And they have been incredibly generous in our state by providing that level of care. But quite frankly, there's only so much you can do and still bring in revenues to be able to pay your bills, keep your lights on, etc. And so so many folks are getting behavioral health services that they simply were not able to pay for before. Are we yet at the level of providing behavioral health services that we need to? No, nowhere near, which is what the 1115 behavioral health waiver is all about, is really looking at our system comprehensively. How can we design a system that will better meet our needs? The other thing, if I can move to the next slide, to talk a little bit about what's happening. I know we have been getting a lot of questions from folks about what's happening with Affordable Care Act repeal and replace. What are the implications for Alaska?
Sir, before you get to that, just on behavioral health treatment, So with Medicaid expansion paying at least through this, through last year, 100% for those behavioral health, for that behavioral health treatment, did that displace any money that the state was paying for those services for people, or did that just add services for people who didn't have the money before?
Mr. Chair, Medicaid expansion has saved the state a number of different ways. One is through the catastrophic coverage, which our state provided at 100% general fund. Over 450 Alaskans were covered for catastrophic coverage, and that number is now less than 10 because those folks are now enrolled in Medicaid expansion at 100% federal match. The other is with corrections. If you are an inmate in corrections, you are not eligible for Medicaid. However, for health care that is provided on a contract basis, so in other words, let's say, I'll use me as an example. Let's say I'm an inmate in corrections. I have an issue. Let's say I have an appendicitis. I need to have my appendix removed. That providing that health care is the Department of Corrections responsibility for that inmate. When that person, so let's say I go into a hospital for an overnight stay during that time period in an inpatient facility, I am eligible for Medicaid. And so now, rather than that being covered at 100% general fund, that is now covered by Medicaid expansion, and so we have saved there as well.
And did expansion displace any state expenditures on behavioral health, or no?
I think I could answer that question about 100 different ways. So let me, if you don't mind.
I want to change my question to make it easier to answer.
While tempting, you know what I'd really like to do? If I may, I would like to provide you with a variety of answers, but provide that information to the committee at a later time, because there have been some pretty significant improvements.
That sounds fine if it's okay with the committee. And Representative Sadler, I see your finger going up and down.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the question of Medicaid reform and expansion is a big one. There's many, many facets, and don't be embarrassed if you're overwhelmed. I was for a long time. So in regards to Medicaid expansion specifically, I want to ask two parameters. If you could speak, Commissioner, to the number of enrollees and the costs for claims, how they are comparing to the projections, and now that you have some actual data behind you, how do you think that might change your projections into the future?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, in FY16, we anticipated that we would need about $145.4 million. Our expenditures in FY16 were $149.5 million. So there was about a $4 million difference in FY16. In FY17, our numbers actually have gone up. Our number of enrollees are, we projected we're going to be about 23,000 enrollees, and our actual enrollment through the end of December is 27,415. We believe that that is an indication of our decline in economy, and quite frankly, more people are now eligible for Medicaid expansion than we anticipated because of our decline in economy and the limited number of and the number of jobs that have been reduced. In terms of the expenditures in FY17, we anticipate that the expenditures will be higher than we anticipated. We think that some of that is due to pent-up demand, and some of that is due to the utilization from folks who simply have not had coverage. That has been the experience of other states, and eventually it does level off.
Thank you. And it was my fault, Commissioner. Representative Sponholz reminded me as I was delving into behavioral health that we have another session devoted to behavioral health. So.
If I may transition, because we have received a lot of calls from the public about what's happening with the Affordable Care Act. The things that they have been talking about generally are repealing Medicaid expansion was one of the first ones. 31 states, however, have expanded Medicaid, including from both parties, both Republican and Democratic states, have expanded Medicaid. And what governors have weighed in have really said that, okay, if you're going to take that away, what are you going to be replacing that with? So that has been a challenge. We have also heard that there may be a potential to eliminate the requirement for the individual mandate for marketplace plans. And when that happens, I guess one of the things I'm thinking about in terms of our economy and our state is if the federal government did a straight repeal of the Affordable Care Act, 50,000 Alaskans now have some kind of coverage, either through Medicaid or through marketplace plans. So how are those folks going to be covered now? What's going to happen with the economic impact of all of those resources circulating around into our economy? There are some specific provisions in the Affordable Care Act that really impact our work on health reform. Health homes, that was described by Ms. Martin, was included as specific authority in Section 1945. The Division of Insurance, our state is pursuing a 1332 waiver that will basically allow us to be able to do a better job with a high risk pool to stabilize our individual market. I mentioned the individual mandate earlier, 1915K options as well. One of the things that many folks may not understand is that private insurance, those marketplace plans, and Medicaid really go hand in hand. Any change that is made to the marketplace plans, either by limiting the 10 essential health benefits, by eliminating that coverage, or by reducing that level of coverage, what that means is it is just a matter of time before people are eligible for Medicaid. Those things go hand in hand and vice versa. When we see better insurance coverage in some cases, we also see that people are able to maintain their independent coverage longer without necessarily having to go on Medicaid. Those two really go hand in hand. The one that we are most concerned about is this notion that's floating around a little bit with Medicaid block grants. Mm-hmm. And if I may be frank, Medicaid block grants really are a way, in a nutshell, what's going to happen there is how they do it is they say, okay, you have this many Medicaid beneficiaries in your state. This is going to be your allocation for the year. Long term, I think Medicaid block grants are really a way to be, or will really be the vehicle to shift that federal responsibility to states. Mm-hmm. One of the things that, these are the kinds of states that do well in Medicaid block grants, and see if this sounds like Alaska. Large population, large concentration in large urban settings. Care is pretty much provided the same. Travel is not an access to care issue. No tribal populations. The economy is stable. Low cost of care. Those states do really well in block grant scenarios. Alaska is none of those things. We have a large state, so if they were doing it based on geography, we'd be set. But they don't. They do it based upon population. We have a small population in Alaska, as we all know. One issue for us is that healthcare is provided differently to be able to meet the needs of Alaskans in their settings. So the way that tribes provide care in a small community is very different than the way they provide care in a large urban setting in Anchorage. IHS beneficiaries, or Alaska Natives or American Indians like Monique and me, are IHS beneficiaries. Those are already covered at 100% federal. So they should not be included in a block grant allocation. Those should be set aside. So unless they make those considerations, states like ours that have a large tribal population are really disadvantaged over other states. The other is states that have a higher cost of providing health care don't do as well. In the original bill draft that we saw, there were allocations that were made for high-cost states and low-cost states. And the sponsor of that bill was from Louisiana, low-cost state. So under those allocations, guess which states benefited? It was the low-cost states. The other is because those allocations are made at the beginning of the year and they generally don't do offsets throughout the year, if you have not hit bottom if you are still trending down in an economic challenging period like we are here, we certainly hear that from the economists, we have not hit bottom yet. That's a problem for us because a number of people who will be eligible at the beginning of the year will be different than the number of people who are eligible at the end of the year. And unfortunately, our opportunity to catch up is not until the following year.
So, Commissioner, so that'll be our nightmare, is the redesign we'd have to do if the law changes. We'll all deal with that later. But I want to make sure before we end the committee meeting to see if anybody has any questions. Does anybody have any questions before we end? And then I'll let people know. The next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, January 31st at 3:30, again in this room, room 106. We'll be addressing the department's work on behavioral health. And with that, I'll, since we jointly noticed this committee, Commissioner Davidson has one other thing to say before I turn it over to Representative Sponholz to gavel out, since she...
Mr. Chair, I'm so sorry. I didn't say one of the most important things. There were a group of folks, Alaskans, including a number of providers, who were able to have a conversation with our congressional delegation a little over a week ago. And one thing that all of the providers said was the kinds of savings that we are trying to achieve in Medicaid reform through Senate Bill 74 will be significantly compromised if Medicaid expansion goes away. Medicaid expansion provides them with the resources that they need to be able to test out those programmatic changes. And so what we have said from the beginning is that we think expansion and reform go hand in hand, and that is certainly what we are hearing from providers.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner. For the record, this is Representative Sponholz. The time is 5:06, and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.